Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear the latest episode in the English Expression Teaching Series, Words and Their Stories, with Anna Mateo. Later, we bring you the American History Series, Making of a Nation. But first, the Higher Education Report.
Understanding the cost of attending a college or university in the United States is not always easy. All colleges and universities in the U.S. are able to set their own tuition and housing prices, as well as charge other program fees. A student may be able to find these costs listed on a school's website or in a college advice book. But such estimates usually do not include other costs related to higher education, such as books and supplies, transportation, and cost of living. That is why the U.S. Congress passed the Higher Education Opportunity Act, which created new rules for how schools present this information, in 2008. Part of this law requires all colleges and universities that accept students' federal financial aid to report on the total cost of their programs. The Department of Education collects data from the schools on average tuition payments as well as averages of other hidden costs. The agency also collects data on scholarships and other forms of aid the schools give to students to help reduce those costs.
Another requirement is that the schools must have a tool on their websites that provides specific estimates of all costs for students. This tool is meant to gather information about an individual's financial situation and calculate how much aid the school might offer them. The tool then presents the student with a price estimate that takes that aid into consideration. The final result is known as the net price. However, a new study suggests that many schools are not fully meeting the law's requirements for these net price calculators. And experts worry this could harm students' abilities to make the best decisions when applying to colleges and universities. Researchers with the University of Pennsylvania's Graduate School of Education looked at the net price calculators of 80 schools. Half of them were public colleges and universities. The other half were private, nonprofit institutions. They were all schools with a high percentage of students who receive Pell Grants, a form of federal financial aid that goes to poorer students. The researchers released their findings last month. They found many of the school's net price calculators to be lacking in some way. Nearly a third of the school's calculators did not meet the federal government's definition of net price, failing to include costs like books and supplies. Additionally, half of the school's calculators were using data that was at least 2 years old. The links to the calculators for five of the schools did not work every time the researchers used them. And two of the schools had no calculator at all.
Laura Perna is a professor at the Graduate School of Education and the lead researcher on the study. She notes that while the group of schools is rather small, the findings do suggest a larger problem. In fact, a 2012 Institute for College Access and Success study of net price calculators at 50 colleges and universities had similar results. Perna's study did not look at why schools might be failing to meet the government's requirements, but she did say there is no governing body at the Department of Education that punishes schools for not providing up-to-date, correct net price calculators. And there is no single design for the calculators that schools are required to use. As the cost of college continues to rise, a school presenting older, less costly net price data might appeal to more students. And a higher application rate makes the school appear more desirable overall, Perna says. Some of the practices, hopefully, are not being done simply because institutions want more applications, but there could be some motivations along those lines as well, she told VOA. But Archie Kubarubia argues that the reasons behind this are likely more related to operational problems that schools face. He is Vice President for Policy and Advocacy for Partners for College Affordability and Public Trust. In 2008, he was working for the Department of Education and helped create the guidelines for net price calculators.
He notes that presenting net price data that is complete and up-to-date is very important. It is especially important for poorer students who might only apply to colleges if they seem within their budget. But Kubarubia adds that the 2008 law requires colleges and universities to report huge amounts of all kinds of data. Not all of it is related to cost, and most of it comes from several different departments within the schools. Institutions with larger budgets are able to make sure that the necessary data is communicated effectively between departments and with the government, he says. Those schools are better able to make sure the calculators on their websites are providing up-to-date information. But that is not always the case at schools with competing budgetary concerns. What ends up happening is because the federal requirements are so piecemeal and different offices are responsible for different pieces, one piece falls through the cracks and nobody's looking at it, said Kubarubia. He adds that the government should consider simplifying its data requirements. Last month, U.S. lawmakers proposed the Net Price Calculator Improvement Act to Congress. It is aimed at creating a stronger definition of the data that go into net price calculations and how schools must present such tools. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Now, the VOA Learning English Program, Words and Their Stories. Today, we talk about a food expression, using something most cultures have, bread. It could be naan bread of India, a pita from the Middle East, or steamed bread from China. The French have the baguette, and Italians have ciabatta. Scandinavian countries often eat heavy dark breads, and people throughout South America may eat deep-fried breads. Some people like to dip their bread into olive oil. Some like to spread chocolate on top. But one of the best things to put on bread, especially if it is warm from the oven, is butter. Bread and butter is a classic combination. But bread and butter also means something almost as comforting, a way to make money. Some word experts say the phrase bread and butter began in Europe and England during the Middle Ages. At that time, many peasants could only afford bread and butter as their entire meal, or they would eat it with soup. So bread and butter was a food staple. And that is what the expression bread and butter meant for many years, a basic item for life. After you got your bread and butter, you could then purchase more items for your household. Then, around the 1600s, the meaning changed. People began using it to mean the way they earned a living, or their livelihood. So that is the origin. Here is how you can use it. Let's say you really like to write and perform songs, but you do not make enough money doing those things to pay for your housing, groceries, and other expenses. So you get a job as a website designer. If someone asks what you do, you could say, "Well, I'm a musician, but designing websites is my bread and butter." In other words, designing websites pays your bills. Making music does not. So you count on web design for your bread and butter. For some people, it is important to have a stable bread and butter job. They get nervous if they do not have a steady paycheck coming in. Being a doctor is a good bread and butter job. If you are an import-export specialist, you could say business and trade are your bread and butter. Now, if you really like your job and it pays well, you probably want to keep it. And if you work for someone else, you probably want to keep them happy. In other words, you should know which side your bread is buttered on. To know which side your bread is buttered on means you are aware of the people who can help you. But this expression has a bad feel to it. It means being unusually aware of how others can help you. Now, let's hear two friends use some of these expressions in a short conversation.
Hey, do you want to go to the football game this afternoon?
I can't. I have to help my girlfriend's dad paint his garage. He may be able to help me get a job at his software company.
I see. Well, it's always good to know which side your bread is buttered on.
Do you have to make it sound that way?
Which way is that?
Like I'm scheming or plotting or something like that?
I'm just saying you're being smart. If he can help you, it's a good idea to help him.
Look, designing software is my bread and butter. And don't forget, I'm the breadwinner for my mom and two brothers. So I'm lucky to know someone who is so connected in the business.
Well, just make sure you stay on his daughter's good side, too. If you guys break up, you might find yourself on the breadline.
Let's change the subject.
And that's all the time we have for words and their stories. I hope you have enjoyed learning about these bread expressions. The story editor, Kelly Jean Kelly, liked it. She said it was the best thing since sliced bread. When bakers started slicing bread, it made it easier to eat. So when something is very good, we can say it is the best thing since sliced bread. This was a very nice thing for Kelly to say, even if it was a great exaggeration. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo. Well, I like bread and butter.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The first 10 years of the 20th century in America were shaped by the strong leadership of President Theodore Roosevelt. And in the second decade, he returned to national politics to bring once more dramatic changes to the United States. Theodore Roosevelt was a distant cousin of Franklin Roosevelt, a Democrat who became president in 1933. In 1912, Teddy Roosevelt organized a new political party, the Progressives. Roosevelt created this new party after he failed to win the Republican presidential nomination. The Republican convention of 1912 had been controlled by conservative supporters of President William Howard Taft. And, as we hear now from Leo Scully and Morris Joyce, the party nominated Taft for four more years in the White House.
As a result, Roosevelt broke with the Republicans, and he and his supporters held their own convention. They formed the Progressive Party and approved a platform that promised reforms. These reforms were proposed to make the government serve the people and carry out more fully their desire for social progress. The Democratic Party also nominated a candidate who supported progressive ideas. The Democrats chose Governor Woodrow Wilson of New Jersey, a former president of Princeton University. So, for the first time in many years, there were three major candidates for president. Wilson clearly had the best chance to win. He had the support of almost all the Democrats. The Republicans, however, were split. Some supported Taft, the others were for Roosevelt.
Roosevelt refused to accept the idea of defeat. He campaigned hard, visiting many cities and towns, making speech after speech. Wilson also campaigned hard. He seemed to enjoy it as much as Roosevelt. Taft did not like it at all. He refused to do much campaigning. He spent most of the time at his summer home. It was a quiet election campaign until the middle of October. Then, only 3 weeks before Election Day, Roosevelt was shot.
It happened in Milwaukee. Roosevelt had just left his hotel and climbed into the automobile that would carry him to the hall where he planned to make a speech. As he stood in the open car, an extremist named John Schrank ran up to him, pulled a gun from his coat, and fired a bullet into Roosevelt's chest. The bullet knocked him down. Roosevelt said it felt as if he had been kicked by a mule. He jumped up and put his hand to the wound. The bullet had passed through the inside pocket of his coat. It struck a steel case that held his glasses and went through the folded 50 pages of his written speech. These slowed the bullet, and it went only a few centimeters into his chest.
Roosevelt did not know if he was seriously wounded. He put his hand to his mouth and coughed. No blood came, and he knew the shot had not damaged his lungs. Roosevelt ordered the crowd around to stop beating Schrank. "Bring him to me," he said. He looked down at the man. "You poor creature," said Roosevelt. Then he turned away. doctors arrived. They said Roosevelt must go at once to the hospital. But Roosevelt refused. He said he would go to the hall. "I will make this speech," he said, "or die. It will be one or the other." On his way to the hall, he told a friend, "It takes more than that to kill a Roosevelt. I do not care a rap about being shot, not a rap."
At the hall, he stood before the big crowd. His face was white, but he stood straight, without help. Someone announced that Roosevelt had been wounded, but still planned to speak. Roosevelt's voice was very low, almost a whisper. "I am going to ask you to be very quiet, and please excuse me from making a long speech. I'll do the best I can, but there is a bullet in me." He paused and then continued. "It is nothing. I am not hurt badly. I have something to say, and I will say it, as long as there is life in my body."
Roosevelt's speech was not important. He said nothing that he had not already said many times before. What was important, however, was his cool courage. Men did not see his act as foolish or overly dramatic. They saw it as the brave act of a strong man. To the public, he was a hero. Roosevelt spoke for almost an hour. Finally, very weak, he let himself be helped from the hall. He was rushed to a hospital where doctors could examine the wound.
The doctors found that the bullet had broken a rib, but caused no serious damage. They decided to leave the bullet where it was. The next day, Roosevelt made a statement from his hospital bed. "Tell the people not to worry about me, for if I go down, another will take my place." President Taft and Woodrow Wilson sent messages of regret to Roosevelt. They announced that they would not campaign until Roosevelt was able to do so.
Roosevelt's condition improved quickly. After 2 weeks of rest, he was ready to continue his campaign for the presidency. He made a speech to a big crowd at Madison Square Garden in New York City. Everyone was surprised to see how strong and healthy he seemed. Wilson ended his campaign in New York City the next day. He told a cheering crowd of Democrats, "What the Democratic Party proposes to do is to go into power and do the things that the Republican Party has been talking about for 16 years.
On November 5th, the people voted. The winner was Woodrow Wilson. He received more than 6 million votes. Roosevelt was second with 4 million. Taft received only about 3.5 million. Wilson's victory was even greater in the electoral vote. He got 435. Roosevelt got only 88. And Taft received only the 8 electoral votes of Utah and Vermont. The Democrats won not only the White House, but also control of Congress. And a number of Democratic governors were elected in states formerly controlled by Republicans.
The 1912 campaign ended public life for Theodore Roosevelt. Soon after the election, a friend visited Roosevelt and talked of possible victory in 1916. I thought you were a better politician, Roosevelt said. The fight is over. We are beaten. There is only one thing to do. That is to go back to the Republican Party. You cannot hold a party like the Progressive Party together. There are no loaves and fishes, no financial support.
War was soon to break out in Europe. The United States would enter the struggle in 1917. As always, Roosevelt was ready to join in a fight. He asked for permission to organize an American force and lead it into battle in France. President Wilson, however, turned down the request. Roosevelt was sure that it was a political decision. He never forgave Wilson for keeping him out of the war. Although Roosevelt himself could not fight, four of his sons went into battle. One, his youngest son, Quentin, did not return. And when he received news of his son's death, Roosevelt wrote these words to honor him.
Only those are fit to live who do not fear to die. And none are fit to die who have shrunk from the joy of life. Both life and death are parts of the same great adventure. All of us who give service and stand ready for sacrifice are torchbearers. We run with the torches until we fall, satisfied if we can then pass them to the hands of other runners. The torches whose flame is brightest are carried by the brave men on the battlefield, and by the brave women whose husbands, lovers, sons, and brothers struggle there. These are the torchbearers. These are they who have dared the great adventure.
Roosevelt's own great adventure was itself coming to an end. He suffered from painful attacks of inflammatory rheumatism and from a serious ear infection. He had difficulty in hearing and could not walk. But the old man was still cheerful. He spent his 60th birthday in the hospital. And to his family and friends, he said, "I am ahead of the game. Nobody ever packed more kinds of fun and interest into 60 years. Death came to Roosevelt as he slept on the night of January 6th, 1919. Said Vice President Thomas Marshall, "Death had to take him sleeping, for if Roosevelt had been awake, there would have been a fight."
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.